Good morning, Council, City Budget Advisory Committee. My name is Tracy Manning. I am the Bureau Director of the Portland Housing Bureau. I'm here with a good chunk of my leadership team, so whatever question I can't answer and CBO can't answer, I'm sure they can. I don't think it's appropriate to dedicate a budget presentation to anyone, but I just want to say that this morning makes me mindful of Gretchen Kifori and our loss this past week. So when we invest in affordable housing, we do more than build buildings. We create communities in complete neighborhoods that are inclusive, healthy, sustainable, and diverse. And we create a lifetime of opportunity for children whose success in life will depend in no small part on their zip code. By building and preserving housing with affordability that will remain in place for 60 years, PHBA projects are indeed investments in the infrastructure of our city. So, we all feel that our city is going through a time of tremendous growth and change. This budget request is designed to respond to three key elements in our current environment: market conditions, displacement, and the new Home for Everyone community plan. So by now, Portland's affordable housing shortage has made national news. We continue a tight rental market with a vacancy of less than 4% in the entire metro area and 11% year-over-year rent increases. 54% of Portland's renters are now considered cost-burdened. That's paying more than 30% of their income for housing. That means nearly 60,000 Portland households face choices about which bills to pay, and it does put them at risk of homelessness. Another issue we're tackling is displacement. Housing affordability is also a key racial equity concern, as the market segregates us by income and race and concentrates poverty. Earlier this year, Portland was named the most rapidly gentrifying city in America in this century. Of the 300 North Northeast community members who took our survey this past fall, nearly half of the African American homeowners shared that they were at risk of displacement, and 83% of the renters felt they were at risk of displacement. Half of them were from communities of color. Finally, we have opportunity presented by A Home for Everyone. Last year, Mayor Hales, Commissioner Saltzman, joined with leaders in the Multnomah County, City of Gresham, Home Forward, and Meyer Memorial Trust to establish a governing board that has moved aside the red tape of jurisdictional boundaries to coordinate community-wide efforts on ending homelessness. Thanks to their efforts, this community has committed to an ambitious goal of meaningfully and sustainably moving the needle on homelessness within 2 years, including answering the mayor's challenge to end the homelessness among veterans in Multnomah County by the end of the calendar year. This afternoon, and I think perhaps in an hour and a half, the Home for Everyone Executive Committee will hear a proposal for how to end homelessness in our committee. This group is taking great strides in data outcomes and evaluation work. I have to give a shout out to James Carter, who has been helping the committee with outcomes and performance measures. And for the first time, we actually have a model that will tell us what it takes to shift from being a responsive system, sort of running to catch up with homelessness, and to keep pace with forces that we don't control, to moving to a system that actually prevents it. So we know now what upfront investment, granted large, but if sustained for a few short years, can dramatically reduce our unmet housing needs by 2020, allowing us to shift sustained efforts toward prevention and a handoff to the anti-poverty system. So if these are the issues we're trying to address, I wanted to share a little bit about our current funding landscape, the resources the city has available to use to address these issues: our tax increment financing, our federal entitlement grants, and of course, general fund. So with TIF, we're in the midst of an 8-year window of stable funding with TIF. It averages an availability of $18 to $20 million per year, although a number of our recent actions in North McAdam and Interstate are going to front load some of those efforts. Starting in the early 2020s, however, as the TIF districts start to drop off, we'll see a substantial drop in those resources. And of course, there's the limitations of the URA boundaries. Someone recently said we can't address the whole city's affordable housing shortage on a very small amount of acreage in an urban renewal area. So for the federal entitlement grants, community development block grant funding actually maintains congressional support. Even with that, this funding stream has gone down 28% over the last 6 years. And then our second major grant that we use primarily for affordable housing development, HOME, has had less support at the federal level. It's had a 39% reduction over the same six-year period, including this year. With the rate of reduction of those two grants has moderated some in the past 3 years. And then finally, of course, there's City General Fund. While rising home values are on the one hand contributing to our current surplus, they are at the same time making the affordable housing shortage more acute. So on to our decision packages. Decision package one is North and Northeast Portland Ownership Retention Program. So this program prevents families from losing their homes in the geography most heavily impacted by the legacy of displacement, and it is our highest priority. This is the same geography that we discussed at length during the North-Northeast process. I do have a map for the benefit of the Budget Committee. Sorry, I didn't get this in your handouts, but it's effectively the area historically affected by redlining and displacement, and it goes from Northeast 33rd to roughly Portsmouth, from Columbia to I-84 in the river. And so the issue is that while interstate urban renewal area runs through the heart of these neighborhoods, it of course, skirts a lot of the residential areas where we're trying to prevent displacement. So PHB allocated $4 million in TIF over 5 years to home retention during the North-Northeast process, but that won't impact the homeowners outside of that boundary. So this package is divided in two. All for homeowner retention in this geography. The first is to extend our existing successful programs into the residential neighborhoods surrounding the interstate URA. These are home repair loans at 0% interest, averaging $30,000 for 22 homeowners who are up to 80% in median family income, and then a grant program, which is for lower income people. Those grants average $5,000 per homeowner and will serve about 30 homeowners.
Tracy. This is home retention money would be for homeowners specifically,
correct?
Not for renters,
correct?
Right? And it's my understanding that historically we don't have much information on how much of the displacement has been of homeowners versus renters.
We don't. It's a question a lot of folks want the answer to, and we're going to work with Dr. Bates to see citywide. We were actually talking to BPS about this a couple days ago, about trying to figure out how to track that. So these funds extend the existing program. Two-thirds of the single-family stock within our study area is outside of the urban renewal area and therefore not eligible for the TIF funds. We have a waiting list of nearly 100 low-income North-Northeast homeowners at risk of displacement who can't access these programs just because of where they live. Our key performance measurement is that based on the current program performance, at least 80% of those assisted will continue to live in their current home for 12 months after receiving services. The second part of this package is another use that is not TIF eligible and would become available throughout the geography, both inside and outside the URA. So during the current community forums, we heard stories directly from homeowners who were struggling to maintain their homes and from stories of friends and families who had lost their home. But very often, the cause of that displacement was not something we could address with TIF, including debt, such as back property taxes, fines for code violations, and a lot of times just lack of access to the financial information for estate planning for elders who wanted to pass on their home, people that had gotten into reverse mortgages and were really struggling to deal with what they needed to do with that. So we have also heard from the community groups who provide the services for the home repair loans that get in and know these families and say, I can complete this home repair and it will absolutely make a difference to this family, and it's not everything they need, but we can't provide the service. And also our homeownership partners, who you've heard quite a bit from, Partners for Affordable Homeownership, have recommended this package. So this funding supports direct assistance of up to $15,000 per homeowner, and that'll be 50 homeowners, and then staffing resources of up to $100,000 for community partners providing the services.
So the City Budget Office didn't recommend this and said that there are not enough details on the program design. Have you been able to provide them with additional details, and is the City Budget Office any more supportive of this request?
I don't think that's changed. We've been in contact pretty quickly. Yeah, the program hasn't been written. It was recommended by our community partners, but all of the details aren't included. PCRI currently runs a home retention program that's pretty similar to this, and so we are relying heavily on the people who work in the community to share that this is a need and that it's been an intervention that they've been successful with. PCRI says they've had 97% home retention from this program. We haven't. Those aren't our numbers. Those are theirs.
Thank you for that response. And you said that there's 100 families currently on the waiting list. Is that from the part that was within the URA that we did a couple of months ago?
No, so that's people who call that are interested in the home repair loan program but are not in the URA.
But
so it's not a waiting list, may be a misnomer. We keep their application.
We currently don't have a program for them.
Not if they're outside the URA.
And how many are we serving inside the URA?
Approximately 10 households a year is what we currently have budget for.
Ten loans a year, and then the grants is probably another 50 per year per urban renewal area.
Tracy, you said that, I think I got the number, almost 100 homeowners were at risk for displacement. Can you describe what that looks like? Are they going to go under? Are they going to be foreclosed on? Or are they just going to have to sell at a loss to predatory buyers? What does that look like?
This was self-identified. But, I mean, I think, you know, sort of logically, the stories that we hear either from our partners or for the homeowners for when we are able to prevent displacement, there's a lot of mortgage issues. There's a lot of people who have serious sort of system failure. Roofs is really common, and they just don't have the money to deal with it, and so they sell.
And have you seen, you know, if we're on the list of number one in the country, what other cities are doing to try to address this? And this is obviously something new, and doing the same old thing hasn't worked. So have you seen any other type of model besides PCRI that maybe reflects on the effectiveness of this idea?
This specific home retention intervention?
Yeah.
You know, we haven't. We have not done national research for a program of this scale. We certainly can. Mm-hmm.
But what you're hearing anecdotally is from these individuals that their home repair will allow them to remain in their home.
So the home repair program is something we've been operating for years. The part that's new is the non-repair portion. And, yeah, we're hearing
the pilot program,
right? And so that's the program. PCRI runs a similar program. And really what it's trying to provide, so as you identified, there's a variety of reasons somebody might be at risk from being displaced from their home. It could be a roof. It could be that there's whatever the repair issue is has created code violations that are stacking up on them. We see a lot of reverse mortgages. It could be a plumbing or a disability issue. Families have these holistic issues. Our funding sources have these very specific things we're allowed to spend them on. And so I think from the stories we heard from the community, from the stories we hear from the providers, the goal is to fill in some of those gaps. So when we go to a person and say, we can say, what do you need, as opposed to, do you have something we can fund?
Thank you. I just wanted to add, with regards to the first half of the package for the 800,000, for the 80-plus to 120-plus households on a waiting list, through conversation with housing in the last week, we've gotten additional information that would change our recommendation as far as funding that particular half of the package. The point of the issue was one of capacity. When we looked at limited PDC data around budget actuals, it kind of raised the capacity of client uptake, provider capacity with regards to providing the home repair. But in conversations with the budget office at housing, they gave some more information that speaks to, you know, there being capacity inside the URA, therefore external to the URA boundaries, there is capacity to meet the needs of those 80 plus households.
So how much are you now recommending?
That's a great question. It would be the 800,000.
Okay, decision package two. So this package is designed to invest one-time city funds in the city's affordable housing infrastructure outside of the geography of the urban renewal areas. It also has two parts. Apparently that's our specialty this year. The Opportunity Fund. So this is what you funded last year for $1 million. These types of investments provide PHB the flexibility to be more nimble in our project funding. Something we've really learned from the current real estate market is our slower processes and policies aren't that quick when responding to changes in the market. It also allows us to invest where the need and the opportunity are greatest, outside of geographic boundaries. And it is also is central to our efforts to end homelessness. If any of you saw the meme on John Stewart, what do homeless people actually need? It's homes. So this funding package will support an additional amount of money for the Opportunity Fund. Currently, we've got two proposals on our existing $1 million fund for a combined total of almost $1.5 million, and we're expecting another proposal. We've received strong interest for another half million dollars. That application hasn't been submitted yet.
I see a question about the HIF. If the council, if you end up getting the $5 million for the HIF, is there anything that prevents you from, in a future allocation, writing into the competitive guidelines that bringing the cost per unit down is the primary consideration? In other words, is this a flexible enough fund so that you could use it to experiment in the marketplace to see how we can bring the cost per unit down?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's actually a major criteria in the current fund. Commissioner Saltzman ratchets that up every time we put an OF out. So, absolutely, yeah.
And just remind me again what kinds of things you use this fund for.
You know, there's two things we're trying to address. One is the geography, that urban renewal areas can't be the only place that we're building affordable housing. And then two is our current NOFA process is designed for lots of great reasons to be very transparent.
That's not my question.
So that fund, you can only apply for once a year.
That's not what I'm asking.
Okay.
I'm asking, is this subsidies for multifamily apartments? Because $1 million in real estate doesn't go very far.
No.
So what is it that the money goes towards that does provide more than four homes?
So it's for multifamily investment. We're never the only funder. It's always leveraged with other funds, bank loans. So I think one of the two proposals received, the rest of the money will be a bank loan and developer equity. The other proposal received is looking for a much deeper subsidy level, and so they'll receive funds from the state. They're doing a great deal of fundraising, that sort of thing.
Are we requiring
in terms of all investments made out of the HIF, are we requiring 60-year affordability?
Actually, you are requiring 60-year affordability. Yeah, it's council direction, policy direction that all city funds have 60-year affordability. 60. Thank you, Mike. Sorry, getting over a cold like everybody else. So that's the Opportunity Fund. The second part of the Opportunity Fund is for land acquisition. It's a tool in the toolbox that's been identified in several national studies. Most recently, the Dukakis Center did a study on maintaining diversity in America's transit-rich neighborhoods. So we talk a lot about toolboxes and do we have all the tools that other communities do. When we identify ones we don't, we try to go after it, like inclusionary zoning. This is a tool we have used in the TIF areas, but not as a city, to purchase land for the purpose of affordable housing development in the future. So we actually have a fund available in our community, although not with city funds in it, for land acquisition for the purposes of land banking for affordable housing development. It's operated by Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, which is a 22-member nonprofit bank consortium established by the Oregon Bankers Association. We would propose these funds to be matched at least dollar for dollar by the funds available at NOAA to do land acquisitions specifically for the purpose of affordable housing development. Our partners in that fund would include the State of Oregon, Meyer Memorial Trust, MacArthur Foundation, Wells Fargo, Chase Bank, KeyBank, and Bank of America. We would want these funds to be more flexible than they currently are. Lower interest rates, longer loan terms, and then we'd have certainly underwriting criteria that we'd contribute, but the loan fund is operated by NOAA, and we think it's a great deal to gain a tool that we don't currently have in our toolbox to try to mitigate displacement and keep costs of affordable housing down. Okay, decision package three, and the Home for Everyone Coordinating Board. So in our city club address last year, Nan Roman, president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, said, "We know what to do, we don't do enough of it, and we don't do it long enough. You have the capacity here in Portland. You have the knowledge." So at last count, as you all know, the total number of people experiencing homelessness in our community was $4,500. Our current investments are successfully moving 3,000 people a year into permanent housing. And while that's no small accomplishment, we've done the analysis to show that it won't be enough to move the needle. To that end, we're seeking additional funds to strengthen existing efforts and to advance this new initiative. In January, as part of Home for Everyone Executive Committee, Mayor Hales and Commissioner Saltzman approved an action plan to house all homeless veterans in our community by the year's end. A coordinated effort by our local governments, the VA, Home Forward, and a network of service providers is already housing more than 55 homeless veterans a month. So this package is designed to do two things. First of all, to match the county in supporting our initiative director. The second is to give the Home for Everyone Executive Committee the opportunity to prioritize what they've, so the committee has asked and the board has asked for actions that would markedly impact homelessness in our community. They're getting those recommendations this afternoon. And so this package is designed to, based on that fund, that committee's priorities. We had a timing issue, obviously. I think it's not exciting for CBO that we couldn't say exactly what we wanted this to fund, but the idea is that this is what this executive committee is spending its time doing. And finally, decision package four is a little bit technical, but it does support our community's goals to end homelessness. So We do not receive, in all of our general fund, we receive a COLA except for the $4.6 million that council allocated when we, in a budget note, allocated isn't the right word. CBO will obviously have to help me out here. The previous funds that were one time only, that council in a budget note said should become ongoing, did become ongoing, but because council didn't direct CBO that those funds would get the same COLA that the rest of our general fund got, they don't. They stay flat, and when the rest of our general fund gets a COLA, those funds don't. Any given year, we can sort of figure it out, and obviously there's lots of years that we haven't received a COLA, but of course over time, time value of money, this starts eroding what these funds can do. And since most of our general fund supports our homeless programs, that's where the impact happens. So, you know, I can tell you a story from my own professional history, receiving for over 15 years federal funds through our continuum of care allocation that didn't ever, ever, ever get a COLA, something every recipient deals with. And they were supporting, I know it was 112 units of housing for people living with addictions. Never, ever, ever getting a COLA. You know, we first few years, you sort of scrap around. Maybe 1 or 2 years, you get a grant. Then you start doing some fundraising. And over time, you just can't support the units anymore. And so I remember the year that I called the Bureau of Housing and Community Development and said, I can't do it anymore. I can't. You've got to let me reduce the number of units that we're providing. I'm out of money to pay staff. Took a long time. You know, it wasn't urgent last year. Wasn't urgent when we asked for it the year before. Eventually, it adds up. And I guess just sort of logically, it seems like all of our general funds should have COLA or none of it, either way. So that's effectively what this package is. Hopefully, CBO has said, we need council direction to fix this. So we're asking you for that direction. There is, because it does indeed have to be ongoing, there is an offsetting cut package that I hope you won't take.
Yes, a couple of questions. On that last issue, the last sentence says CBO doesn't recommend it because there were no expected results based upon the budget guidance. It doesn't say they don't support it, but it seems to me that there's...
This is the last package, the COLA package, yeah. We need to get a little clarification. I don't know if my understanding of this is that there was 1 year of a missed inflation around that 4.6%. I thought the 4.6 million, excuse me, I thought that was growing every year. I'm sort of looking at Mike Johnson to see if he knows. I'm pretty sure it is. I think there is a gap there, and we've talked to the Housing Bureau before about it, that we were directed to add 4.6 million, which we did. There was a year missed there, and inflation on 4.6 million is not insignificant. And so I think, you know, that's essentially what they're saying is, you know, had it grown the year we added it, we would have been able to provide more services. I'll have to clarify, Tracy, on whether.
Okay. It's yeah, my understanding is that it wasn't ever would not ever be subject to COLA unless you receive further direction from council.
So you're, Andrew, you're saying it's a one-time request, not an ongoing request?
Well, it would still be, even if 1 year was missed, it would still be ongoing to fix
to
it.
To add to the COLA on the 179.
Just like cost of living for employees, right? You know,
right.
When you add the 2%,
but it would be 2.1%. It would be 2.1% of 179. It wouldn't be another 179.
Right, it wouldn't be compounded. But we'll confirm. We know that. I just don't know it here today. We can, you know, crosswalk whether it was added, whether it was missed for 1 year, or whether it's been missed for multiple years.
So Andrew.
But overall, the issue is, I mean, essentially, yes. I mean, Tracy outlined it. We were directed to add an amount. That amount is lower than what the Housing Bureau, you know, would have been able to provide otherwise. Really, what this is, it's $180,000 to increase housing services. So
based upon that last sentence, if I mean, you're not supporting it, but you're not saying you don't agree with it. You're saying you don't support it because housing didn't submit what they were supposed to submit. Non-submission of expected results per budget guidance are the exact words you used.
Yes. So when the Bureau submitted a decision package, part of that submission is laying out expected results. So what's the consequence of funding? What's the consequence of not doing funding? So the basis of my analysis for the bureaus in my portfolio is looking at expected results based on what's on the decision package, coming to some level of confidence whether those expected results are going to pan out or not pan out.
And I agree with you 100%. So you've got, it seems to me you've got a couple of things to think about, as do they. Second of all, I was surprised with your last short-term rent assistance cut. It seems so contrary. It seems so contrary to what your charge is. And it seems to me it's cheaper. I mean, you're talking about $4,000 per household. It seems to me it's so much cheaper to keep people in housing than it is to deal with it once they're out. So I just don't understand why you would...
Why this is the offer.
Why you would even think about cutting that. Especially when you're hiring a human, you're hiring an FTE. I mean, I'd rather see this stay and the FTE not hired.
Yeah, understood. We can't get the money out the door without our staff. I mean,
But you're talking about a half a person, so.
Well, yeah, and the half a person wouldn't cover this cost. That wouldn't be sufficient. I'd have to keep going into additional staff. I mean, the issue with homeless programs, and you'll see in years where we get more money, we also put it into straw. And places where we have little cuts, we take them from straw. And the reason is that it's not facility-based. It's just very, very flexible. Our providers spend as much of it as they have available. And if there's less available, they spend less of it. And if we have more available, we also put it in this pot, and out the door it goes very quickly. As opposed to a shelter, it's very difficult to cut $80,000 from a shelter because so many of their costs are fixed and in staffing. So particular reason for you to believe this, but we actually did scour the budget because I said, look, I don't want to put up homeless programs again. Where else do we spend general fund? Well, we do spend some general fund on overhead, but it's the lease payment is the biggest place we spend general fund on overhead. Well, I can't pay for part of the lease.
Well, I would just hope you and the council would reconsider. That seems to me, for those 45 people, that's a huge life-changing event.
Yeah.
Lastly, and you don't need to really, this is not really a question, but I keep reading in non-Oregonian publications, so I want to get that on the, you know, there's this perception that government housing, acquisition of land, building of affordable housing is so much more expensive than the private sector. That it's so inefficient, it creates, and it's so it's better for that for the private sector to do that. Is that accurate? I mean,
no.
If you look at square feet, the cost per square feet is there a difference?
Yes, and I think we're looking at maybe having a council work session on this issue. But yeah, that's definitely something that we're spending a lot of time looking at. Not just in Portland, California actually just studied the whole state. Minnesota did a big study. There's a national study by Urban Land Institute and Enterprise all about the cost of affordable housing. What costs more? When does it cost more? Is it worth it? Is there anything we can do about it? And so we're doing similar work here.
So back to Commissioner Fish's, which I thought was a very perceptive observation. As a citizen, my perception is it costs the city a lot more of my taxpayer money than it does for a private contractor to build housing. Therefore, I'm less supportive, i.e. the sewer, water versus transportation. So it's either true, so we have to correct it, or it's a perception problem, which we have to deal with.
Don, can I just make one comment? There's some innovation in construction methods that is helping to drive down costs. For example, modular housing. And the city experimented modular housing out in Lentz a couple years ago with NEA, and it was promising. And one of the things the city learned is that the real savings come in building it to scale. that, you know, 6 to 8 units, you get some savings. But if you imagined a full build-out of a multifamily building with modular, you could drive down costs. Now, that's an example of innovation in production methods. And also, it turns out there are businesses in Oregon that make modular housing. So it's a great way to cross-subsidize industries that are in rural Oregon. The biggest policy question we're going to have to take up is how many of the policies that we in the public side care about are we willing to make more flexible in order to drive down costs? How important is it to us that workers get paid a family wage? How important is it that buildings are green and built for the long term with energy efficiency? How important is it that low-income people get to choose to live in high-opportunity neighborhoods and not just distressed neighborhoods? I mean, how important is it to us to have services on site for people that need the help? Those are big policy questions. And, you know, every dollar of public subsidy triggers a discussion about how many of our values follow those dollars. And Tracy and Dan and others are leading this discussion. But it isn't as simple as one would think, because many of these are policies the council holds dear and the community holds dear, like prevailing wage. And we don't have the flexibility just to say they go away. That said, what if we could harness the competitive competition in the private sector, as Dan is doing, to come to the city and say, we can build this cheaper, still within our values, like using modular housing, maybe smaller footprints, different kinds of innovations. Now, that would be really cool, because we'd be stretching the dollar without compromising our values.
So if you reduce all those variables and compare the costs, are they about the same?
I guess it depends on what all those variables are.
Well, I understand
if we
the
use,
values. I understand the values.
Right.
I agree with those. But you ought to be able to reduce it down to as few variables as you
just
can.
Just building the box. Sure. If you're just building the box, people can do it for effectively the same price. Shields Oblitz explained it to me once. Even within the private market, there's people that build all along the spectrum. You know, you can build extremely inexpensively, regardless of whether you're for-profit or non-profit. We've got some beautiful, wonderful, effective, affordable housing developments built by private developers, for-profit developers, that also happen to be some of our more expensive per unit for lots of really good reasons. It's a much more complicated question than you'd think.
Well, I'm sure it's complicated, but once it gets out of the public, it's not complicated.
It costs
more for the city, less for the private, therefore, why are my taxes going to pay more? That's simple, but it's a complicated problem, but there's a simple perception.
Yeah, it's very true. Thank you.
So I'd like to ask a question about your performance indicators, but let me preface that by saying that Tracy and your staff have been frequent guests at the Planning and Sustainability Commission between urban renewal districts and the comp plan. And I think it's the whole PSC is aware of the challenge in front of us to produce the amount of affordable housing that's necessary to meet the needs of the residents of the city. And that's why I want to focus in on your performance measures, that they don't really illustrate meeting the need as far as I can see. There's a lot of measures that are about effort, you know, number of units produced in a year, but they're not calibrated against the need. So, you know, give you an example from Parks. Parks has a measure for what percentage of people live within half a mile of a park. Mm-hmm. So we can assess how well they're meeting the needs of the community. I don't really see any of your indicators that are scaled against how many units are required to meet the needs of the city. And, you know, it would seem to me it would help illustrate better the resources you actually need to meet your mission, if we showed that in the indicators.
Thank you. Yeah, we will work on some of that. Thank you.
It's getting late, so lightning round. And some of these are just requests for information rather than necessarily getting it today. Tracy, my first question is, if we took the remaining one-time money and all the ongoing money and gave it to housing, could you spend it in this next fiscal year?
I'm sure I could,
okay,
yes.
Okay, well, I just wanted that on the record. You know, we're going to be taking up PDC's budget in a little while, and they are the conduit for your 30% set aside. Andrew, do we have a good chart over the last 5 years of the money, of the 30%, how much has been spent by Urban Renewal District and how much is left?
Yes.
So we can all get a copy of that? Okay. Dashboard. I think I want to make a couple suggestions on dashboard. The first is that I think that it would be useful to consider having both a new construction and a preservation dashboard, since your bureau does such a good job on both. And we're talking still about 0 to 60 MFI. But since you rehabilitate and preserve a lot of units in addition to building units, and since those are units that are typically at risk of being lost, it's a different side of the same conversation, but I would say that that's that is a dashboard we ought to consider adding, and maybe do it as two columns side by side so that you can see them together.
The same.
Mm-hmm. I had trouble reconciling the dashboard data that you currently have with just my anecdotal memory. And I know that you and Dan are coming in April with a whole presentation on data. And starting FY13-14, you produce an excellent set of documents showing how you spend your money, your dashboard. But for example, the rough number that I have, 08 to 013, is about 3,000 units that you either built or preserved. And the dashboard shows about 1,000. And what I couldn't find in the dashboard, for example, is I just took randomly Gray's Landing, Bud Clark Commons, a couple other things, and I got by a factor more units invested in and built in FY10-11, FY11-12. So rather than deal with this as an abstraction, do you have the underlying data of the various projects and the units?
We sure do. Yeah.
So if we could circulate that, because I'm not sure whether I'm just reading this incorrectly or you have a different methodology. I think you're still focused on 0 to 60. But I don't see Bud Clark Commons here, which is 130. I don't see Gray's Landing, which is 205. So I don't understand the numbers that are currently in the dashboard. And I think it's possible they're off by a significant amount. Or at very least, let's look at the underlying data and just figure out what we're measuring. But again, I think preservation, since you've done such a great job in that, ought to be a separate dashboard. Number three, on the HIF, we currently commingle our funds with the county in a lot of areas. We put the straw money together, and Mr. Wood, I thank you for your comment about the offset on straw, because I turned to Dan and asked if you were a plant. I mean, the council has consistently said to the Bureau that's one of the best investments we make as a community. It's one of the most cost-effective. It has the greatest return. So it's a rather painful cut to have to put that in there. And I think we have to, my own view is we have to defend short-term rent assistance. But in terms of the HIF, since we commingle a lot of funds with the county, is it our intention, if you're asking for $5 million for the Opportunity Fund, is it your intention to ask the county to match that so that we have $10 million and we can really do some business?
I may well be my boss's intention.
So they have, I mean, they're flush with general fund discretionary too, and you've made the case that it also leverages other resources. So this would be a great idea, a great example of the city and county working together, and I hope if we do consider the $5 million that it comes with the proviso that the county matches it, so we can double our. Do you have a request in this budget for fair housing? Because we did make a commitment to at least regular testing. So do you have a follow-up request for monies to handle the next round of testing?
We have that in our budget.
It's in your budget?
Mm-hmm.
Tracy, I noticed that someone's going to pull out the chart we got at the beginning of the hearing, and and the one that has Portland Housing Bureau and your base budget, and they're going to say, oh, my God, that you've just the number has skyrocketed in the last couple years. And, of course, it's because the council converted your one-time money to ongoing. So you were the classic example of having a shadow budget of one-time and ongoing. It looks like you're one of the highest performers in terms of your base budget going up, but really all we did is we took your serial one-time and we made it into the base. Is that correct, Andrew?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. That's a big chunk of that base budget increase, yes.
And that's it for now, but thanks for an excellent presentation.
I wanted to prompt a little CBO housing smackdown here on the topic of the land banking. It seemed to be just off the cuff that doing land banking seems like, you know, reasonable long-term strategy. And one thing I want to ask Tracy is, are there very many other long-term strategies that you are able to pursue at all? And I know that CBO did not allocate money for land banking, and I've heard a bit about why CBO said that, but I'd like to hear some back and forth on it.
Yeah, well, obviously, development of affordable housing with a regulatory agreement is our primary other long-term strategy, but that, of course, is in the moment, and it doesn't secure future affordability.
I know you guys are wanting to end, but I did want to ask a couple of things. I wanted to weigh in on the dashboard, too, and other people brought up some really good points. I like to, when I looked at the dashboard on something like housing, it's neat if you can see, just kind of get even a sense of like what the whole housing thing is all about. And so one of the things that occurred to me is that return on investment or something, like you're getting like $5 million, and is there some way to show like what it brings, mm-hmm. so that you can look at this and say, you know, for X dollars we got X people housed, and so anything that you can do, and I don't even know how you would structure that, but that's something that I felt like was missing there. And then it sounded like when I heard you talking about saving those homes in North and Northeast, that you have people who, for a variety of reasons, aren't able to keep their homes. Now, one of those reasons has to have been predatory loan practices. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that outside of the city's scope to go after those banks or anything like that?
Not completely, but I think that's probably it's a non-budgetary question that we ought to follow up with you on.
Well, it said that it so impacts the budget. The other thing that I want to say is that is a relatively large amount of money for a small amount of return at this time. I am not speaking against it. I'm just pointing out that you've kind of gone into an area now that is already a hot market, and so you're trying to save these homes. And so what I'm trying to point out is that as these hotter markets move into East Portland, you will save yourself a lot of money by thinking about these issues ahead of time and trying to address them ahead of time, so that when East Portland begins to heat up, you're not going to have to go in with $10 million to save a few homes.
May I make one observation, yeah. Mayor? You know, we mentioned Gretchen at the beginning. We should also mention John Gray. And to your point, when Mr. Gray, before he died, he gave a rather large chunk of his philanthropy to Habitat for Humanity. And they went in the teeth of the recession and they bought land in East Portland when it was affordable.
Perfect.
And yeah. The reason that you're seeing this huge expansion of their footprint in East Portland is they used his dollars, the kind of dollars she's talking about, to land bank. And they bought it when developers were abandoning projects and people were trying to sell dirt. So that was one of the great gifts that he gave our community. And then Habitat capitalized on it and is building it out. Let me offer the other side of the case. One of the challenges we have in North McAdam is once we do parcel 3, what's the next opportunity? The city's negotiating with Mr. Zeidel for potentially developing a piece of dirt. If we were able to acquire that dirt now, then it will be a much more cost-effective development. If we can't negotiate price or buy it now, and all the wonderful things happen in North McAdam, then you know what happens. In 5 or 10 years, when we try to acquire that dirt, we pay a premium, to your point. So this is where doing it upstream is extremely cost-effective, both in East Portland and in urban renewal districts.
Exactly, and maintaining a neighborhood, you know, I mean, the people want to stay in their homes in North and Northeast. I honor that. But it's going to be extremely expensive now, whereas 15 years ago, it would have been a lot cheaper. So bear that in mind as East Portland changes. Let's see, I think that was... Oh, just the other thing is the Oregonian had a whole series of articles about homelessness. Probably a bad time to ask you, well, what did you think of those articles? But there was one on about this builder who could really churn out the apartments. And I was impressed. He sounded, it was interesting. I can't remember his name. But one of the things that I worry about is for East Portland is that somebody comes in and just does that, and we have all these apartments built at the same time, and they're kind of cheap, and then in 30 years, they're just going to look terrible. So know that that opinion is out there, and that's probably not the way I would want my part of the town to develop. Thank you.
So before we close, let me see if... Oops, sorry.
Didn't see You sit right next to them, not in the peripheral vision. Yeah, it's okay. So one of the housing requests, which isn't in the Housing Bureau's budget, is the rental housing inspections, because that's in the Bureau of Development Services where the inspectors lie. And I'm wondering, so we do have a request from Development Services to expand that inspections program, which of course speaks to Katie's point of quality rental housing. Commissioner Fish led a group before the recession to look at potentially adding a surcharge of $5 per unit to pay for rental housing inspections. I'm wondering, is there any, would there be capacity within your current staffing to revive that discussion, or do you need to at this late stage add another add request for staffing to revive that proposal?
It certainly wouldn't take an FTE to do something like that, but let me get back to you about what it would take.
Thanks, because it's one where you can almost wish we could co-sponsor between bureaus the different budget asks, because it really more properly, I certainly don't have the staff within Development Services who are familiar with all right. of the partners and able to lead that process. I would, our request is for a one-time ask as to expand the program, and so if I would be very supportive if you want to come back with a request for staffing for that, because ongoing, it could be a way to pay for services. Housing isn't necessarily seen as an enterprise bureau, but I think there may be some places where you might be able to get some partners to provide some revenue in it. So I'd like you to come back with that request.
And if we also clarify that the industry agreed to that surcharge as part of a package of reforms. This is not a new tax. They agreed to it, provided we did some other things, and that's the question. Are we going to implement the whole package?
Right.
Yeah, it's a huge need. Thank you.
So before we close, Dante, any particular comments on how this bureau used the equity lens?
Thank you, Mayor. I think quite well. I was very impressed with the depth and breadth by which they completed the document itself and spoke to the issues East Portland, spoke to the need to address the gentrification issue specifically. And I guess in that regard, I have a question maybe back to the SmackDown Commissioner. You know, the CBO seemed to indicate that, one, you hadn't identified any particular inventory outside of the URAs to purchase in the land bank, and then secondly, you should stay within the URA and use unallocated TIF money, but you also spoke to your desire or need or interest in stepping outside of the URAs to do this work. One, is the first statement true? Is there identified inventory? And second, why is it important to step outside of a URA to do this?
It's true that I don't have inventory that we've identified that we would recommend a nonprofit apply to purchase for these funds. So that's true. I don't know that our nonprofit partners aren't aware. Certainly we've all heard from Kali Neighborhood of some parcels they'd be interested in. And I mean, I think the issue around the URAs is something that certainly folks are familiar with. The areas that we map for opportunity areas that are at risk of displacement sometimes are behave themselves and map to URAs and oftentimes don't. And so I think the city's desire is to solve the affordable housing problem, not just on that tiny amounts, bits of acreage, but where it's going to do our citizens the most good.
So to not relegate folks to a particular area to be able to purchase where they want.
Housing choice, yes.
So yes, I mean, I think their assessment overall was very well done in terms of who's impacted, where people are impacted, geography of all of this. So I would give kudos to the Bureau on this. Thank you.
So Dante had previously graciously told me privately or pointed out about the parks issue with considering folks with disability as part of our equity lens. Can you both give me some information about accessible housing for people with disabilities and whether that's addressed at all within your budget requests?
It's not an issue we've figured out how to tackle, and it'd actually be another great partnership with BDS just in terms of data systems and how do we track when someone has built, with universal design that's accessible, or a lot of our partners build units that are convertible so they don't, you can only be in that unit. And we don't, frankly, have an answer to that yet.
I will say, Commissioner, having sat on a couple of the NOFA panels, that that's an absolute consideration in determining what some of the best proposals are as it relate largely. How are people with disabilities considered in the creation of the proposal and in the development process? So it is absolutely a consideration in the NOFA process.
So one thing I wanted to highlight that didn't come up in this conversation is just a question around the city's investment in evaluation, particularly third-party evaluation. In the last 7 years, the city has invested about $51.6 million in general fund to house the homeless. In the next 7 years, we're forecasted to spend about $102 million to assist those needing a home and helping them to find permanent housing. I think there's a question of, you know, what are the opportunities for our service providers to improve? What are the opportunities for the system to learn from those high-performing service providers? What are those opportunities to have someone from the outside who doesn't have any biases, any cognitive biases around being critical of the services they're providing? What are the opportunities to have an objective third party say, hey, you know, Portland, you're doing well here. You do better here. This is how your sister jurisdictions do. So I think, I mean, with investments in direct services, I think the city would be served in putting some level of investment and evaluation, just as far as this process improvement, learning improvement. I think we do well, but I think there's always an opportunity to do better.
The other thing, just quickly to sort of follow up on Dante's point, I just want to make sure, you know, our analysis around sort of the URAs inside and outside the URAs wasn't intended to say there's not a problem outside the URAs. I think what we were getting at is there's a problem both inside and outside, but there are some additional resources that are still available inside. And so when it comes down to prioritizing general fund and where that goes, the question was, I mean, if we had solved these housing issues within the URAs and spent all the set aside, then yes, you know, let's move outside of that. I think we're saying there are issues that need to be solved everywhere. So let's focus on solving those issues where we have some existing resources that are available instead of spending some of the limited resources outside. Once, you know, we do that, we can move outside as well. I think that was the intent. It wasn't to say that problem doesn't exist.
And additionally, we're spending about 70% budget actuals as far as our resources allocated to the housing set aside. So it kind of raises the question of, you know, not only spending your existing resources, but asking for new resources, seeing how you can get all the money out the door that is provided with set aside.
Yeah, so I'd like to spend a little bit of time on that statistic because we, if you sort of look at the PDC dashboard, the housing money gets out the door extremely well. I spend all the money I have, near as I can tell. So if there's something you want to check up on, let's do that for sure.
Follow up on that. That would be helpful. Any more last requests for information? Appreciate everybody staying extra time. Appreciate being able to get through three good reviews of three bureaus so far. More to come.
Yes, week from Thursday.
Week from Thursday.
Can we have the dashboard sooner than?
Yes, yes. You will get all the other dashboards late end of this week. Yes.
Done. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you all.
Good job.
I'll give them all that 90 days.